So it's a very great pleasure indeed to be able to participate in this meeting, which is unbelievably creative and visionary, and particularly in such a spectacular and iconic setting. So I'd like to thank the organizers for the invitation to contribute. So what I want to do in the next 20 minutes or so is to discuss and share some ideas around one of the great emerging medical disciplines of our time, which is regenerative medicine. And as you've already heard from our chairman, this brings with it much hope, but also a certain amount of caution, risk, and perhaps even fear. Now, at the core of the regenerative medicine promise is a rather tantalizing prospect that future medicine, fueled and catalyzed by significant advances in stem cell biology, may be on the cusp of being able to deliver for people meaningful and restorative solutions for diseases that until now have hitherto been regarded as irreparable. And so this potentially is a very great advance indeed. Now, of course, renewal, immortality, youth, the desire for eternal youth is not a new construct. It's been with us since time immemorial and has fascinated humanity throughout. But whilst this has been perhaps the subject of fable, myth, philosophy, and religion for many years, I would like to argue that advances in stem cell biology in particular, but building on very great advances in science across the piece, we've already heard about the contributions of mathematics and indeed physics, are beginning to challenge some of our long-held assumptions, perhaps not in terms of negating what it means to be mortal, but certainly in terms of what might be possible in repair or renewal of organs. And I'd like to discuss this concept and illustrate the theme by focusing on repair of the damaged brain. And I focus on the brain because this reflects my own interests as a practicing neurologist. So if I were to begin with my first slide, and I could not come to Athens and talk about regeneration and not present this slide. Now, what this slide serves to highlight is that, as with most things in life, there is very little that is new. And the legend of Prometheus, in a sense, really captures this. Now, Prometheus, as you will all know, literally means foresight. And this legend is remarkable in that it anticipates and predicts the very discussion that we're having around regenerative medicine. Because as you will know, the very nature of the particular punishment that Zeus imposed on Prometheus was that this was a punishment to be endured on a daily basis, because the eagle would come in the day and devour the liver, but the liver would regenerate during the night. And so the punishment would endure day after day after day, and therein is a particular cruelty of this form of torture. Now, regardless of whether the ancient Greeks understood the concept of regeneration in the liver, it may be, and I suspect this is more likely, that given that the Greek gods were imbued with a sense of immortality, that this attribute was also extended to bodily organs. But nonetheless, this legend serves to highlight some of the key core concepts that dominate the field of regenerative medicine. And we can illustrate this in this slide or cartoon, which I will use to demonstrate operationally at least what a stem cell is and what it can do. So if this schematic was to work, what you can see here is the liver, and the liver now has been injured, and here is your stem cell. And the point about a stem cell is that it can do two things. It can self-renew, but it can also give rise to specialized progeny. And in this case, the specialized progeny are the hepatocytes, which in turn will give rise to the liver. So over time, this stem cell will make more and more of itself, plus more of these liver cells. And therein lies the capacity of the liver to repair itself, something that we all understand. Now, it is these twin properties of self-renewal and specialization which make stem cells such an attractive proposition for regenerative medicine. And the challenges of regenerative medicine are vast indeed. And it is arguably the greatest public health threats to the modern world are diabetes, neurodegenerative disorders, of which more later, and heart failure. And the challenge for doctors and patients indeed who suffer with these diseases is really very simple. What people want is they want treatments that will slow, stop, and ultimately reverse these diseases. This, until very recently, has been the stuff of fantasy. But what I will try and argue is that some of this may actually become possible. But I really want to emphasize the, if you like, the core narrative that runs through my talk, but I think the entire meeting, which is the idea of discovery. And stem cells and regenerative medicine is at a point of discovery, and it's a long journey. And the challenge for all of us is really to use this as another vehicle to improve our understanding of how the body works, and crucially also what happens in the context of injury. And what does repair mean? And perhaps more importantly, what does the failure of repair tell us about how to repair, if that makes sense? And so I will try and illustrate this by focusing on the brain. Now, before I do that, for those of you that are non-neuroscientists, and I'd imagine that would be most of you, I'm going to give you a very quick primer of the brain. So what I'm going to do is tell you everything I learned in medical school about the brain. Now, believe you me, that will not take very long. So the brain at its heart can be considered to be the consequence of the collection of two types of cells. The obvious cell is the nerve cell or the neuron. But the neuron does not work in a vacuum. It works in a very tight cellular environment, and it is surrounded by cells called glia, or glue. And the details of these cells don't matter, but when the glia or the glue work in harmony with the nerve cells, what you have is a fantastic symphony, if you like, of electrical activity, which is coordinated. So this is what we understand the brain is about. It's essentially a network, albeit wonderfully sophisticated network, of electrical wiring. And when that wiring is right in physiology and in health, it underlies our ability to think, to feel, our actions, our speech, and indeed even our emotions. Now, this is captured better than my words by this quotation from Hippocrates. But actually, at the time that Hippocrates was describing so much, the idea that the brain was the soul, the seat of the soul, wasn't necessarily universally accepted. And people like Aristotle, for example, would have argued that the heart was where the soul resided. And it took another major Greek figure, physician and anatomist, Galen, to begin to unravel this and also apply some precision to this. And one of Galen's many achievements was to begin to study in detail the brain and to break down structure. And by his anatomic precision, he really paved the way, albeit interspersed by a couple of millennia, for others more recently to begin to ascribe structure and function and make the link between function and structure. Now, this, of course, we all take intuitively. We all understand from our own experiences that if you're right-handed and you have a damage to your brain on the left side, there's going to be a problem with your right hand. We understand that. It's obvious to us now, but it wasn't for many millennia. But what this idea of structure and function also highlights in the context of the brain is the importance of regarding the brain not as one single modular unit, but rather this rather complex network. And we've already heard about complexity. It also highlights another principle which distinguishes the brain from any other organ. Unlike other organs which you can replace or repair in its entirety, think of liver transplants, kidney transplants, heart transplants, we simply cannot conceive of replacing the whole brain. That has all kinds of philosophical ideas and implications, but practically, even if some thought it was desirable, it's simply not feasible. So what it means, really, that for repair of the damaged brain, we need to undertake, if you like, a bespoke or tailored approach to that. And I'd like to illustrate this concept of bespoke treatments by reference to two diseases, Parkinson's and multiple sclerosis. So Parkinson's disease, you will all be familiar with. This is terribly common, and after Alzheimer's, it's the second most common neurodegenerative disorder globally. It derives its name from James Parkinson, a bit of a polymath, who in the 18th century, I think it was, yes, the 18th century, described this disease. And what he wrote was an essay on shaking palsy. And one of the defining features of this disease is the shaking or tremor. And that's what he described. Now, the point about Parkinson's and why I use it here is, at its simplest, it can be regarded as a disease which is the consequence of the loss of one cell type, the cell that is yellow, which lives in one part of the brain, which is the midbrain. And so conceptually, that lends itself to the thinking that you could replace or repair damage in Parkinson's disease by replacing that single cell type in that single site of the brain. So this is the idea of cell transplantation as a form of treatment. And indeed, this has been pioneered by some very great figures such as Anders Bjorklund in Lund. And there have been about 250 patients worldwide who have had cell transplantation for Parkinson's disease. And we can discuss the implications of this perhaps later on. I want to contrast Parkinson's disease now with multiple sclerosis. And I've used the image of Jacqueline Dupré, a very famous cellist, to illustrate two important features of this disease. The first is it affects the young particularly, and it's arguably the most common cause of acquired disability in the young population, certainly in the industrialized world. But also it has a predominance of affecting women. Now, Jacqueline Dupré, who was a fantastic cellist, died in her early 40s as a consequence of this disease. So the other point about this disease, which is illustrated in the cartoon below the image, is that it affects not just the nerve cell, but also the myelination or the insulating cell. And so this idea again of harmony. And when you break up this harmony, you get a disturbance, which is the disease. But also you can see in the MR scan image, and we've heard about the importance of mathematics for brain imaging, and brain imaging really is our tool or our way of accessing the brain. It's our window into the brain, which is a tool we're increasingly using. So what I've told you so far is a rather bleak tale. I've told you that the brain is fantastically complex. I've told you that there are these diseases which are devastating and progressive and incurable. And so it all sounds pretty grim, and maybe we should give up the ghost and go home. But actually, what we've begun to learn in the last 20, 30 years is that the brain, much like other organs, even like the liver perhaps, has an innate capacity to repair itself. And this is illustrated in this post-mortem sample of a brain tissue from somebody who would have died and who themselves had MS or multiple sclerosis. This is a spontaneous process that occurs in the brain. So this gives us the idea that the brain does indeed have the capacity to repair, but it is incomplete. So the challenge for the research community is to understand why does it occur and why does it fail, and by unlocking that conundrum, you've then got the beginnings of treatments. And looking ahead, what kind of treatments might we anticipate? Well, the prediction is that the future will be a combination of treatments that will look to promote endogenous repair, that we've already discussed, but also in certain cases, exogenous repair. So this is the idea of parachuting in cells or stem cells. So this again, this interplay between exogenous repair and promoting an innate capacity to repair. And of course, these are not mutually incompatible. So given that these are people, you need to be doing this with human stem cells. And this brings me to one of the very major advances in biology over a very short time, really the last 15, 20 years. So what you can see in terms of the image is an example of a stem cell. So that cluster or ball of cells, just to give you a sense of scale, is sitting on the head of a pin. So these are unbelievably small. But in these small cells is unbelievable power. So embryonic stem cells, which you can see in the cartoon, were first isolated in the mouse in the early 80s, for which the Nobel Prize was awarded to three people, including Sir Martin Evans from Cambridge. But human embryonic stem cells were first isolated just as recently as 1998 by Jamie Thompson in Madison. And the point about these cells is that these are pluripotent. And by that, I mean that every one of those cells, because it's a stem cell, can make more of itself, but it has the capacity to specialize to all 200 cell types that make up the body. So therein is an enormous power, and sometimes people regard this as the, if you like, ultimate master body tissue repair kit. I'll come back to the adult stem cells and the power of that in a moment. So stem cells, I've told you, are very powerful, and these pluripotent stem cells, by definition, are immensely powerful. So that one embryonic stem cell, by definition, can make any cell type, and with that great opportunity also is a certain amount of risk. And I illustrate that with this image. If I could have the video running, please. So this is an image of human embryonic stem cells growing in the lab which have spontaneously differentiated into this structure. Now, you don't need to be Einstein to know that this represents pulsing cardiac muscle. So what's happened is these embryonic stem cells have differentiated into heart muscle, which is functioning, which is pulsing away. It's a very compelling image, and it shows you the power of the system. But as a neurologist, you wouldn't really want this pulsing away in your brain, and that also shows you the risk of these cells. So as I come towards the end of this talk, I want to touch on one of the ideas that our chairman raised at the beginning, is the power of genetics and the exploitation of genetics. So this is arguably one of the most famous, if not the most famous sheep in the world. This is Dolly the sheep. And this comes from the Athens of the North, Edinburgh. This is where Ian Wilmer, a colleague of mine, first cloned Dolly the sheep. Now, the point about Dolly the sheep, which was one of the major discoveries of the last century, is it illustrated the power of the human nucleus, or of the human genome, and that all cells could be reprogrammed. It's a concept called somatic cell reprogramming. The details don't matter. But building on these advances, which in turn build on advances by colleagues such as John Gurdon in the 50s and 60s, we are in a new era of almost personalized stem cells, which is an unbelievable phenomenon, which I will illustrate. So this is the idea that you can take from a patient a very simple skin biopsy, a size no bigger than, say, a tiny coin, and from that skin biopsy, you can grow cells. And those cells, using very simple techniques, can be converted readily into these master stem cells, which we call pluripotent stem cells. So this is from an individual, an adult, with disease or without disease. You can then convert them into the brain stem cells, and those brain stem cells can then be converted in those different types of neurons that are appropriate for whichever disease you're interested in. And this is exactly the sort of work that we do in our lab. And so, for example, you can see here that using such approaches from an individual, a healthy individual, or a diseased individual that may or may not carry an inherited disease, you can generate bespoke, coming back to that idea of personalized, tailored cells. So you can make the cells that are lost in Parkinson's disease, motor neuron disease, the wonderful oligodendrocyte with the arborization in the bottom right as you're looking, which is the cell that's lost in multiple sclerosis, and of course the astrocyte. So this is my penultimate slide, and what I want to do now is, if you will, is just step back from some of the detail and excitement and consider some of the wider concepts and place this in context. Now, immortality, is that really such a terrific thing? And the idea of biological immortality sounds ridiculous, actually, and unrealistic. But what I hadn't realized until recently, there is a jellyfish around, which actually is an example of biological immortality. This jellyfish, in a sense, is a living example of the potential of biological immortality. Now, I'm not arguing that that's the fate that comes to all of us. In fact, I would have argued that that's really not desirable. But I use it really to illustrate the wider idea of the implications of repair and renewal of organs, but particularly the organ of the brain, because the brain is, in many sense, represents our identity, ourself, our soul. And the implications of cell renewal, cell repair, regeneration of all organs are fascinating, but those of the brain, I think, are particularly loaded. And I'd like to end this talk by coming back to where I began, which is that regenerative medicine, as I would see, is really just a journey, and we're only at the beginning of that journey. And I can think of no better way of capturing that in this audience by referring to this famous poem, Ithaca, I believe, from Cavafis. And it describes very beautifully what I think is at the heart of science, which is the idea of exploration, discovery, and uncharted discovery. And finally, given that we are speaking in the Onassis Center, there is a certain natural symmetry to this, given that Onassis himself was a fantastic example of voyage and discovery. Thank you very much.